Genealogy by Tim, Episode 3. Welcome back for the third episode of Genealogy by Tim. Today is Friday, August 6, 2021. With schools closed and summer in full swing, this past month has been very productive for genealogy research. I'll give a quick rundown of the discoveries I made during last month's trip to Lancaster and Sunbury. Then I'll describe some apparent advancements that I've made in Smith family genealogy and the heartwarming family outing that led up to it. Lastly, I'll mention what's going on with the tech behind the website. There have been some outages lately, and I'll mention some potential ideas for fixing them. All this coming up on Genealogy by Tim. So the highlight of my summer, and usually my year, is the annual bike trip that I take from the Philadelphia metropolitan area to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in order to research my paternal grandmother's Pennsylvania Dutch ancestry. I extended my trip this year to the Harrisburg area, and later to Sunbury in Northumberland County before returning home. This is the trip that I've been hyping up in the first two episodes of the podcast. Well, here are some of the things that I've discovered. The first leg of the journey centered in the city of Lancaster and in West Hempfield Township, just west of the city. At the Lancaster Mennonite Historical Society, I was able to capture some late 18th century tax records from West Hempfield Township, where my sixth grade grandfather, John Hogendobler, lived. John Hogendobler, you'll recall, is my qualifying ancestor for membership in the Sons of the American Revolution. Tax records revealed that he was not only a taxpayer, but also a tax collector for the years 1780 and 1781. This was interesting because the Revolutionary War was ongoing during that time. What is unclear to me is whether John was still collecting taxes for King George III or whether he, by that time, was collecting taxes for his local government. From what I remember of grade school history, tax collectors for the king were despised in their communities. I vividly remember the old image of Loyalist Bostonian Customs Commissioner John Malcolm being tarred, feathered, and manhandled by colonial sailors. So I wonder about John's reputation in the community and to whom the taxes he collected were remitted. Besides capturing the West Hempfield Township tax records, another mystery I was able to solve in Lancaster was my relationship to the Philadelphian prize-winning blacksmith Charles A. Hogendobler, who was the son of Frank S. Hogendobler of Mountjoy, Pennsylvania, Lancaster County. Findagrave currently lists Frank S. as a son of Joseph and Fanny Hogendobler, but I had suspicions about this relationship, and those suspicions turned out to be justified. The years carved on the family's gravestone monuments showed two children, John and Joseph, to have been born in the 1830s, and two other children, Frank S. and Joseph, to have been born in the 1850s. These years suggested to me that the latter, Frank S. and Joseph, were grandchildren of Joseph and Fanny, not children. Fanny's 1872 will on file at the Lancaster County Archives proved this to be the case. In that will, Fanny Hogendobler specifically set up trusts for her grandchildren, Frank S. and Joseph. Their father, John, died in 1871, leaving their grandmother, Fanny, to provide for them upon her death. So the relationship between Frank S. and Fanny Hogendobler is clear. And that proves my relationship to the Philadelphia Inquirer Prize winner, Charles A. Hogendobler. He is my third cousin three times removed, and if he still has any descendants in the Philadelphia metro area, I would be interested to meet them. Despite these research successes, some of my planned research in Lancaster had to be foregone, as the Lancaster County Historical Society still has strict visitation policies in place that include reserving a ticket ahead of time. I had not reserved my ticket ahead of time, and by the time I had gotten there on Wednesday afternoon, they were fully booked until Saturday. So if any of you out there are planning to visit the Lancaster County Historical Society this summer, I strongly recommend visiting the Health and Safety Protocol section of their website, which I have linked in the show notes. And I recommend reserving your tickets at least a week in advance. It's probably good advice for visiting any library, archive, or historical society for the time being. In between Lancaster and Sunbury, I stopped at one family history site in Middletown, Dauphin County, just outside of Harrisburg. It was a stop suggested by one of FamilySearch.org's headstone discovery notifications, which notified me of the headstone of Johannes Mumma, who was born in Germany in 1736 and died in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania on June 11, 1816. If the FamilySearch family tree is to be believed, this Johannes Mumma was a brother of another sixth great-grandfather of mine, Peter Mumma. I was able to visit and photograph his headstone, which, if the relationship checks out, will be the oldest gravestone that I have photographed to date for my personal family history research. Getting to the site was a bit of an adventure. The site is located in an ancient family burial ground within a small grove of trees in the middle of a farm. I did not request permission to walk onto the farm. I just sort of traipsed through, hoping not to be seen, and getting my story straight in my head in the event of a confrontation. Fortunately, there was no confrontation, and I did not need to use this story, but I'm interested to learn the official policy of the landowner, whose identity I do not yet know, and whether this landowner is aware of the researchers who cross over the farm to see the gravestones in the grove. Apparently, I'm not the first to have done this. Find a Grave contained photos of all known headstones in the grove before FamilySearch notified me of their existence. After Middletown, I spent a couple nights in Linglestown and witnessed a beautiful display of 4th of July fireworks at the home of my girlfriend's mother, and from there I rode up to Sunbury to conclude my research for this trip. Sunbury is the county seat of Northumberland County, Pennsylvania, where my fourth great-granduncle, John Hogendobler, moved with his family in the 1860s. One of my goals in Sunbury was to photograph the gravestones of John and his family in the Pomfret Manor Cemetery. I was able to accomplish this rather quickly on my first day there, and fulfill a Find a Grave request in the process. But other family history documents were not as easy to come by. Perhaps the most interesting thing I learned at the Northumberland County Courthouse was that John was not the first Hogendobler to move to Northumberland County. That distinction probably goes to John's granduncle, Joseph Hogendobler, who settled in Milton, Northumberland County, sometime around the turn of the 19th century. Milton is about 10 miles northwest of Sunbury, so I did not make it out that far. But this branch of the family left more will and deed documents at the courthouse than the branch I went there to research. I might have to pay a visit to Milton during a future bike tour, but the trip is not yet planned. My findings were similarly limited at the Northumberland County Historical Society. I went there to gather as many newspaper obituaries as I could and to follow up on the infamous Hogendobler mercy killing trial of the 1940s. The Society did have several newspapers on CD-ROM, but I found them difficult to read through and often not including the years that I needed to search. The trend at this historical society, and probably many others, is to outsource their newspaper needs to newspapers.com, the subsidiary of Ancestry.com, that has scanned countless newspapers across the country. The Northumberland County Historical Society had me look through some old newspaper indices, and when I found something of interest in the index, a historian at the society would use newspapers.com to find the obituary details. I thought, hey, this is great, but it's not what I ride 300 miles in the summer sun to do. I can go to newspapers.com from home for a fraction of the cost when you consider lodging and other travel expenses. So, when I got home from my trip, I did indeed purchase a 6-month subscription to newspapers.com, and I used it to read all about the Hogendobler mercy killing trial, which did create a bit of sensation in the local media. Over the course of 2 months in 1941, the Sunbury Daily Item reported various details of the arrest and trial. Initial reporting began following the incident on the 9th of April, 1941, and continued over the following weeks with police evidence gathering, tests for Mr. Hogendahler's sanity, and other trial-related issues. I mean, the item later reported on the appointment of counsel and alternate jurors before detailing the trial itself and the eventual conviction on the 7th of May. And Mr. Hogendahler's imprisonment on the 14th. Two articles each contained a picture of Mr. Hogendahler for my family history records. The paper seemed mostly sympathetic to him, repeatedly describing the poverty in which he lived, the diminished mental capacity of both he and his wife, and the death of his mother, as well as the desertion of his father, who left the family to settle in Oklahoma. After the trial was over, the Daily Item quoted Mr. Hogendahler as saying that he was happy he didn't get the electric chair, and that he was satisfied that he will now have a place to eat and sleep for the rest of his life. The state of his existence was so dire prior to the murder that prison was a relief for him. Mention is made of how his health visibly improved within days of his arrest. Mr. Hogendahler declared jail fare as, quote, far superior to what he was accustomed to, end quote. And jail attachés described him as, quote, a model prisoner who never causes trouble, readily follows orders, and has no bad friends, end quote. John Hogendahler died at Graterford Prison on May 19, 1948, about 7 years after his conviction of nephrosclerosis. His body was donated to the anatomical board, but this death does not seem to have been reported in the Daily Item. My genealogy tour of Pennsylvania this year ended with a 126-mile ride over mountains and through rain. I got back home on or about the 8th of July with lots of paperwork to file, the filing of which will continue in the months ahead, and as I make interesting connections in the course of the filing, you will hear about it here on the podcast. Although my siblings are interested in the discoveries that I make, I usually do the research on my own. That was not the case on Tuesday, July 20th. Ancestry was a family affair in Broomall, as my brother Kevin and his two children and I found a relative of ours in the Glenwood Memorial Gardens. The cemetery is directly adjacent to Kevin's property, so his daughter, my niece, Evelyn, told me that she has a map of the cemetery in her mind. She can now put that map to another use since we discovered her first cousin, three times removed, John Quinlan, in the cemetery. John Quinlan was a police officer and Vietnam War veteran who lived in Upper Darby and died in 2010 at the age of 69. He was interred in the mausoleum at Glenwood Memorial Gardens. This offered a bit of a diversion from the young one's usual rounds about the cemetery. We had to get the key to the mausoleum from the cemetery office to go inside. The children had never been in the mausoleum before. When we were finished at the cemetery, we all had dinner together, and Evelyn was so excited about Ancestry that I went ahead and copied my full family tree onto her laptop computer using the free Gramps genealogy software. I am super excited to have the next generation interested in family history. Our next outing is planned for the St. Peter and Paul Cemetery in nearby Springfield, where more of our relatives are buried. I hope to make that trip before the end of the summer. The afternoon I spent at the Glenwood Memorial Gardens rekindled my interest in researching my Smith ancestors, from which the Quinlans are descended. The Smith line has been one of my most neglected lines, mostly due to the intimidation of researching such a common name as Smith. When one looks up Smith in the city directory and finds three pages of results, one tends to get a little discouraged. The irony here is that the only great-grandmother I knew as a child was born a Smith, so the ancestry of the only great-grandmother I had as a child has gone neglected. That all changed this past month as I took the Family Search's global tree to discover more of my Smith ancestors. A decade ago, I thought this work was intolerably tedious. Today, the work is tolerable thanks to Family Search's document hints. When I first logged into Family Search's tree, I was able to trace the Smiths, beginning with my great-grandmother, Joanna Christina Smith Harrison, back to her parents, William Smith and Elizabeth Harkins, who were both born in Ireland and emigrated to Philadelphia. From there, I traced William Smith's parents back to James Smith and Maria Tierney, and here's where things got messy. You see, I never had any indication that James Smith and Maria Tierney Smith ever emigrated to America, but the Family Search Global Tree had placed them in Boston, Massachusetts. It seemed unlikely to me, and some age and date inconsistencies within the family convinced me that it was riddled with errors at that point. I wasn't wrong. Through careful review of the documents, I was able to separate James Smith and Maria Tierney into four distinct families, each headed by a James Smith and a Mary or a Maria. Three of these families lived in Boston, and one lived in New London, Connecticut. Of the families that lived in Boston, the maiden names of the mothers were all different. There was a Maria Tierney, a Mary Doan, and a Mary Clancy. The children of Mary Clancy were easy to spot because Mary Clancy was born in San Francisco, likely a child of the Gold Rush, and any documents referring to a mother born in San Francisco had to be children of Mary Clancy. The children of Mary Doan were also somewhat easy to spot because several of them have unique names, such as Urena and Albretta. By working my way through the Family Search site's document hint suggestions, I believe I was able to separate the four families and merge all duplicates to isolate the James Smith and Maria Tierney family. After doing all this, I'm open to the possibility that I may have Smith cousins in Boston. I haven't yet seen any Boston documents specifically mentioning a son, William, in Philadelphia, but the documents seem to contain no obvious inconsistencies and are quite specific in some places. For example, my great-grandfather, William, may have had an older brother named Bernard. Boston documents allege that Bernard was born in County Galway, Ireland, as William was. Birth records also allege that Bernard was born in Kiltormer, County Galway, as William was. Bernard and William seem to have had a younger sister, Susan, who was born in Boston, and two younger siblings who died in infancy. So the records are consistent and contain no obvious impossibilities. What remains unclear is how and why William ended up in Philadelphia. It would seem as though William emigrated to Boston at the age of one with his family, but census records do not seem to show him with his Boston family at the time. So while there is still plenty to explain, a preliminary view of the documents does seem to suggest that I have some Smith relatives in Boston. Perhaps the mystery will be solved this month as I pore further over these digital documents. If your family tree is in a similar state in Family Search's global tree, that is, with several families bound up and entangled together, my advice to you is only to leave the tree in a better state than you found it. Carefully resolve as many document hints as you can, and attach the documents to all the family members that you can find. Create family members that you can't find. Resolve all the duplicates. There will be many. In some cases, duplicate people have been created for each of the several different versions of a document. Once you resolve all document hints, attach all documents to all named people, and resolve all duplicates, you can more easily compare documents against each other to see which ones seem to belong together and which ones don't. You can then proceed with the work of pulling people out of families where they don't belong and placing them where they do belong. Remember, perfection isn't quite the goal. The goal is to leave the tree better than you found it. You may be unsure of some of your actions, but as long as you can reasonably justify what you're doing, you're very likely helping the accuracy of the tree. I'll leave you this month with a word about self-hosting. Hosting turns out not to be as easy as the pros make it look. My site and this podcast have suffered several lengthy outages. Some were caused by my own carelessness, accidentally unplugging a machine and then leaving for a trip or a long weekend. One outage was caused by a power outage in my apartment. On the 21st of July, a hailstorm in Jenkintown knocked out power to my apartment for almost 24 hours. If you're self-hosting a website and your power goes out, guess what? Your site goes down. In one instance, my database suffered some corruption and took me several days to figure out how to restore it. All of this is leading to one place. I need to create a backup server, so that in case one of my servers goes down or suffers either corruption or a faulty upgrade, I can switch to a backup to avoid downtime. It seems pretty easy for me to do, but it requires that I purchase a few small hardware items. I'll keep you posted on any progress I make on this front, but that's all I have for you this month. As always, keep on digging. Your next family history adventure awaits.